This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Visit progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary, not available in all states or situations.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
They were lied to. You know, doctors told them that they had a medical condition that required medical interventions rather than a psychiatric condition that would desist later on. They aren't told that it's a psychiatric condition with a very high rate of desistance. It's very worrisome that young people are told that there's something, you know, kind of wrong with them.
What have some of your experiences with detransitioners?
If gender ideology were in vogue when I was a teenager, I most certainly would have been.
Today's episode is the brilliant Christina Buttons. She is a liberal science-oriented independent journalist who primarily reports on news and research related to gender medicine. Her other writing interests include pseudoscience, mental health, autism, and social justice ideology. And she also contributes to Reality's Last Stand, along with her partner, Colin Wright, who was the evolutionary biologist who spoke on the last episode. So Reality's Last Stand, but she has her own Substack as well, Christina Buttons. Go and follow that. Get hold of her Twitter and her Instagram and all of those things. Make sure to see what's what with her. She's a really lovely, wonderful person. She was formerly at the Daily Wire, but she left because she could no longer in good faith maintain her employment there because of some of the sort of sensation and things. I haven't actually looked in too deep into the ins and outs of that, but you certainly can do that if you so please. So yes, we're going to talk today about, well, a mix of things, because it's not, I'm looking for things that aren't just sort of the gender stuff, and that's why Christina's so interesting. She's got her own experience in the sort of autism world, and we're also talking about Paris Hilton and these kinds of places where it almost, I guess you see them in like Malcolm in the Middle, I don't know, these sort of schools for misbehaving or problem children, teenagers. And Paris has been sort of coming out and speaking against them. Oh, what a terrible experience I had. And I think Christina has a bit of a different view and says, look, you know, I don't want to sort of put words in her mouth, but I think there's a feeling of, hey, you know, this is for your own good, and this is some discipline. And there's a suggestion that Paris has actually made up a lot of stuff, or there's a lot of stuff that Christina Buttons finds she cannot corroborate. So that's really interesting. Do go follow her, as I say, Christina Buttons on Instagram, Twitter. Get on the Substack. Look at Reality's Last Stand as well. That's her partner Colin Wright's and hers, her Substacks. And I will see you at the end. What is the troubled teen industry? Because you and I messaged a bit back and forth about the troubled teen industry. I didn't know what that was before you spoke to me. So what is that?
The troubled teen industry is a variety of different kinds of group homes, wilderness camps, and residential treatment centers, places like that, that congregate care facilities is sort of like the broader term, that take teenagers in who aren't able to live or function in a home environment, and they have facilities where they take these kids in and offer them therapy in a structured environment, discipline. I mean, they're not summer camp. They're not supposed to be fun. It is discipline-oriented. Mm. They can be very militarized, sort of inspired by military boot camp types of things. But they've been recently getting a lot of attention in the last 4 years due to Paris Hilton having gone to one of these facilities And I happened to go to the same one that she did.
Yeah. So tell me what led, we'll get on to Paris Hilton then in a minute. What led to you, I mean, how much are you able to talk about what led to you ending up at one of these places?
I am what you would have considered a troubled teen back then. I had a lot of psychiatric issues that were mostly due to Asperger's not being detected early. I didn't get diagnosed until I was an adult, but I had a lot of social behavioral issues as an adolescent and into my early teens that made it so that I wasn't able to sort of live and function at home. I was considered sort of like a danger to myself. And that led to my long-term stay in a residential treatment center called Provo Canyon School in Utah for a year and two weeks in mid-2010s. 2004 to 2005.
Okay. And this is a place where they are, what are they doing day to day with you?
Well, it's also an accredited school. So it's, you know, like 11 to 17 year olds. Occasionally there'll be an 18 year old that'll stay to finish their education program. But it's a facility where you are locked in. There's no leaving. Everything that you do is managed on a very tight schedule. There's, you know, different types of individual therapies and group therapies. So you a lot of rules that you have to learn. And discipline when you don't follow some of them. Right. Follow the rules.
And how did Paris Hilton end up in this place? Was that, I mean, presumably she's a fair bit older than you, isn't she? So sometime before
she was there in the late 90s, under different management. So I think in 2000, they came under new management. So what she described in this documentary that she released in 2020 was, and her mom was interviewed in it as well. Her mom said that she was, when they moved to New York, she was at 15, sneaking out, going clubbing, wearing skimpy outfits, not coming home for days at a time, just scaring the bejesus out of her mom. Because she was worried that she would get, you know, run into a predator and she wouldn't listen. So she was famous, had a lot of money, had a fake ID. There was nothing stopping her. She wouldn't listen to her parents. And her mom felt at some point she had no other choice but to send her onto some residential care facilities in a different state. And funnily enough, I actually followed a very similar pathway that she did. She went to a place called CEDU High School, which is less restrictive. There are like facilities where you can walk about and do whatever you want. On the premise, but you get therapy and things like that. She ran away from that. I also ran away. And then you kind of get elevated to like the next level of care, which was like a wilderness camp. We both went to the same one. It was called Ascent in Idaho. She ran away from that. I went on a hunger strike, and then I was placed into the next level of care, which was Provo Canyon School.
Right. I see.
So it operates on a level system, and that one would represent like a level 13 or 14 lockdown facility where, you know, you enter and you can't leave until they deem you ready to leave. And if you are to visualize one of these places, they kind of are modeled similarly to like a psychiatric hospital where they have wards, or we call them units, different levels.
I see. And so recently Paris has been speaking out against these places.
Yeah.
Why?
There's this narrative, this very sensationalized narrative out right now that these places are just widespread systemic child abuse. And a lot of other people who have gone to these places have come forward, and they're sort of contributing to this narrative that they were abused and treated very badly. And, you know, I follow this issue fairly closely because it's of interest to me, because I went there as well. And I just have kept waiting and waiting for like to see some more of like a nuanced and balanced perspective, and hear from maybe some of the parents who were kind of at their wit's end and didn't know what else to do. Hear from some of the people who worked at these facilities and mental health professionals, just to sort of offer, you know, another perspective. And I keep waiting for that to happen. I still haven't seen anything. It's everyone has just sort of uncritically accepted all of these claims that there's just widespread abuse, rather than this is just something maybe that will happen occasionally. And so I think it's time that someone actually does come up and say, like, I didn't witness any abuse of any kind. I think what they were doing is standard practice. And it's, there's a lot of claims being made that what these facilities are totally unregulated and things like that. And that's just, that's not true at all. Heavily regulated by state health departments, but not federally regulated. So there's this idea that, you know, because they're not federally regulated, a lot of people have decided to use that word now, that they're unregulated. It's very misleading. They call them survivors of the troubled teen industry. I mean, this all kinds of media have covered this topic very uncritically when talking to the people who went to these facilities. And they, I don't think, are grasping the whole picture.
Because you were in the Facebook groups. Is it right that they were, that people were sort of conspiring to make up stories about those schools?
I was invited into some of these Facebook groups early on. Some of the, because Paris Hilton has an activist organization. And I was interested early on, like I was glad this was getting attention. And I thought like, oh, this is great. But yeah, I started to see things that I was a little, a little suspicious. Because, you know, Paris Hilton came out with this documentary in September 2020. And then 2 years later, came out with sexual abuse allegations, like pretty severe ones. I mean, she documented all of the trauma she apparently experienced in the facility in this documentary, hired animators to depict her getting punched in the face and things like that, and held in this little tiny dark room. And I found those characterizations to be, I mean, I'm highly skeptical. And also the depiction of the observation room was off. But you know, she didn't mention anything about sexual abuse until 2 years later. She said that she had blocked these memories out, which I'm suspicious of. That sounds a lot like the, you know, the repressed memory movement. But, you know, when I went looking in some of these Facebook groups, I found them sort of talking amongst each other about, you know, cervical exams that they thought were suspicious, and trying to find out if they could sort of, it just felt sort of like they were trying to craft a narrative around sexual abuse. And then all of a sudden you hear Paris Hilton come out with this wild story that she was taken in the middle of the night to a room by male staff and digitally raped.
Right.
Under the guise of a cervical exam. And I'm like, I'm very skeptical of a story like that and claims like that. When I was there, nothing like that happened to anyone that I know.
Do you think this comes from a misplaced desire to frame everything from a narrative of victimhood?
Yeah. Well, it's trendy right now. Social justice activism. I feel like this is her rebranding herself. This is what she does. She's very media savvy. She's, you know, entering another phase of her life where she's become a mother, and she's gonna, you know, redirect her life the way she pleases. And this seems to me just an opportunity for her to become a social justice warrior. She's gotten involved in legislation too. They've gotten involved in a number of bills that are being passed, which I can't really speak on the bills themselves because I haven't read them thoroughly. They have to do with more accountability, which I'm not against, but she also has a petition with 200,000 signatures to shut down Provo Canyon School. And that is where I think I have to draw the line. Like, I think these facilities do serve a purpose and they do help people, and they did help me.
Mm.
And the other girls that I've reached out to on Facebook that I've spoken to, they're doing much better now. So there are benefit to these places.
I see away luggage a lot when I travel. As much as I love its looks, I prefer soft side suitcases and always wished Away made one. Well, guess what? Now they do. This suitcase seriously looks better than any old school soft side suitcases I've seen, and is designed to be lighter than others on the market. Soft side comes in 4 of their best-selling sizes and tried and true colours. There is something for everyone in the lineup: 2 carry-on sizes, 2 checked sizes, 4 colours, black, blue, pink, grey. Made from a high-strength nylon, the bag is tear-resistant as well as weather-resistant. I spilled a little bit of coffee on the grey one this morning and can confirm the claim holds up. The bag is soft but not sensitive, super durable, flexible and expandable. Bonus points for the compression pad system that helps you pack it in, and the anti-tipping stabilizer that holds the bag steady while expanded, both of which are proprietary to Away. And that's actually my favorite bit. It doesn't sort of wobble this way and that. I absolutely pack mine full, take it everywhere I go. Well, when I'm going on holiday, that is. And no matter what's packed inside, it doesn't seem to tip. You've got to check out the new soft side luggage from Away. Head on over to awaytravel.com/heretics. That's awaytravel.com/heretics to see the new soft side luggage from Away. awaytravel.com/heretics.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
It seems like the old maybe movie narrative of, you know, the doctors are all the bad guys and, hey, just let us be ourselves, that kind of thing. But as you say, it seems like it's also saving a lot of young people's lives and helping them to have a slightly more disciplined way of living.
I mean, the approach there in Utah, I think, was so much more helpful than what the kinds of therapy I received growing up in California. It was very focused on, you're accountable for your actions. You're responsible for your life. You got yourself here and you have to get yourself out. And after a few weeks, I took that to heart and I realized, like, that I was responsible for my life, that I was, that my actions led me to this facility, and that I needed to do the work to, so that I could be released. I mean, this place, I did not enjoy it there. It was awful. Like, it was heavily discipline oriented. It was very difficult, but I don't know if, I mean, sometimes difficult things are good for us, you know, to experience so that we are become stronger. And that's sort of my perspective on this facility. Whereas in California, it was what I was speaking about earlier, like, it's not your fault. Everyone else is to blame, that type of therapy. And that didn't help me at all.
I think you're right to say that that aspect of Scientology is actually quite good. And a lot of cults, when they say to you, hey, no, you can have some power, it's just that all the other horrible abuses that go on with it are horrible and not very good. But it's the Jordan Peterson thing as well, isn't it? Make your bed.
Yes. Yeah. No, I really appreciate that about him. And I think that's why he's gotten so popular and taught. I guess a lot of young men gravitate towards that message and have learned self-respect And I think it's very valuable today.
Why do men move towards that more than women, do you think? I suppose we can only speculate why men are more attracted to this idea of like, hey, I can do anything, I can make my own bed.
Well, I think that men today are receiving a lot of the opposite message from the left, that their masculinity is toxic. And that's why they gravitate towards those messages in particular, that, you know, have some self-respect for yourself, make your own bed. I'm glad that that messaging exists, because I think that it's much, much more beneficial and healthy for a functioning society.
Absolutely. What is, you mentioned the repressed memory group. What is that?
The repressed memory movement during the, I think, the late 80s and in the 90s, there is this therapy fad where this idea that, you know, any difficulty you're currently experiencing is due to repressed memory of some kind of horrible trauma that you had that you couldn't remember. What ended up happening is that, you know, these patients were kind of vulnerable and suggestible, or they would go under some kind of hypnosis and memories would sort of be planted into the patients. And it led to just, you know, horrible outcomes for some of these patients who, you know, a lot of the times the memories revolved around incest that never happened, and it just destroyed families. People were actually imprisoned due to false allegations. I mean, they stopped. This is actually what ended up ending the whole repressed memory movement, were lawsuits.
Wow.
And they no longer allow that kind of testimony in court, but they did for a time allow repressed memory testimony. And it destroyed people. And there are a lot of parallels to that with what's going on with the gender medicine industry right now.
Yeah, we can get onto that as well then. What exactly do you mean by that then? And what's going on in the gender industry?
There are a lot of parallels to it. There are, because it was a pseudoscience-based movement. It wasn't grounded in facts or evidence. And, you know, it was ended by lawsuits, which predictably is what's going to happen as well with detransitioner lawsuits. But this, you know, practice took off, and it was, and the repressed memory movement in a similar way, it just sort of took off in the media, and it was just endorsed heavily, and it was just widely accepted for a very long time that this was a thing. You repressed memories of trauma you had no idea about, and then you uncover the trauma and you work through it and supposedly heal from it. It ended up being total nonsense, but that's sort of similar to what's happening today with the treatment of gender dysphoria, especially in adolescents and young adults. It's based on this pseudoscientific notion that one possesses this innate gender identity, and that it can differ from your body, and that the body can be changed to match the innate gender identity. The problem is that there isn't any robust scientific evidence that they've been able to locate an innate gender identity in the brain or anywhere else. There's no objective test for it. And this has been, you know, the justification to offer medical interventions to minors, was this idea that they're born this way and there's nothing that they can do to change it. And my own research on detransitioners confirmed that finding too, that doctors are telling their patients that they have a medical condition that requires medical treatment, or that being trans is some kind of biological aspect of who they are that they can't change. And they aren't told that it's a psychiatric condition with a very high rate of desistance, that, you know, 60 to 90% of children will outgrow. Many of them will be gay as adults. But what I think that they're confusing is gender nonconformity. Gender nonconformity, there's, you know, tons of evidence to support, you know, prenatal, gonadal hormone exposure during development. It leads to all kinds of, you know, natural human diversity, preferences and behaviors and physical traits even that deviate from what is stereotypical for the male or the female sex. Deviations from that represent gender nonconformity. And this is just, you know, as I said, just normal human variation. But I think people today are interpreting their gender nonconformity as signs that they possess some kind of underlying trans identity or innate gender identity. And this is being, you know, it's very worrisome that young people are told that there's something, you know, kind of wrong with them when this is just sort of a natural aspect of human beings.
What have some of your experiences with detransitioners that you've, because have you spoken to and met a lot of them, what are your experiences with them? I mean, they must be in a right state right now.
Yeah, the reason I became a journalist 2 years ago was after reading detransitioner stories and finding that I had a lot in common with them, with my sort of troubled upbringing. And I would have been, you know, if gender ideology were in vogue when I was a teenager, I most certainly would have been, if it wouldn't have taken much for someone to convince me that I was born in the wrong body and I would have been better as a male. So it's just terrible what they're experiencing. They were lied to. You know, doctors told them that they had a medical condition that required medical interventions rather than a psychiatric condition that would desist later on. And now they were offered treatments based on just very low quality evidence. And, you know, there's a reckoning right now on all of this sort of coming to light.
Yeah, it's incredible what's been going on. Is there any way to reverse a lot of the stuff they've gone through?
Well, there's not even a standard of care for detransitioners currently. And I found that many insurance companies explicitly exclude detransition care.
Wow.
There's no billing codes for detransition, and they're just sort of left, you know, with these consequences. And, you know, what I was saying before about, you know, being responsible for yourself and your own decisions, like, I don't hold that to detransitioners. I feel that medical providers and doctors and therapists in this case are solely responsible for perpetuating this pseudoscientific notion of innate gender identity and offering medical interventions to people who, you know, for a lot of them, a trans identity was a temporary thing.
Yeah. And what was it? I mean, it's so hard to know what's really going on with the parents and the kids, and the doctors have a duty, of course, to remain scientific, and adults have a duty, I think, to look around dangerous corners for the children to see what's next for them. They don't know. And it feels like we spoke about Paris Hilton before, and we spoke about children who are led to believe certain things. I've talked about it a fair bit on the podcast, but I did a lot with exorcism, for example. If you tell enough kids that they've got a demon inside them, it's remarkable. An entire country will start believing it. There are countries around the world where they really do believe in exorcism, and it seems to be the same age, 17-year-old, 16-year-old girls who either in one country might go through exorcism, in another they might say they have a gendered soul, let's call it,
right,
or whatever's in vogue at the time. I remember, I think it was it Helen Joyce talking about this, that in Japan, anorexia wasn't really a thing,
right,
until American movies started making their way over there. So again, that was now the thing. It's that difficult age, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's also a lot of these psychiatric conditions are very like culture based. And you're saying belief is a very, very powerful thing. Transgender is a Western culture bound concept. So you have virtually identical cohorts of young people in other countries that haven't been sort of affected by this Western medical framework, like the Fafafine in Samoa. There are young boys who we would sort of think of are probably gay. They're same sex attracted. But they have, you know, young gay individuals typically are very gender nonconforming. So a young gay person may not understand yet that they're gay, but they like feminine things and like hanging out with other girls. And they may, anyway, this group in Samoa, they, you know, would have been perfect candidates for the Dutch study. They're gender nonconforming gay children. And they typically grow up to be, you know, well-adjusted gay men. But in the United States and in some other countries, they would be medicalized and have their puberty interrupted and be put down this pathway towards lifelong medicalization. So that's why I say that trans is sort of this, it's very culture bound. Mm. That's why I've become, you know, sort of critical of psychiatry as a field too. I mean, what we have are symptoms and, you know, like the DSM, you know, will list a lot of different kinds of disorders and a lot of different symptoms. And we look at these symptoms and we think, oh, maybe I have this. But some of them, more than others, seem kind of like arbitrary designations.
Hmm. What does that mean, arbitrary designations?
Well, I think that like dissociative identity disorder, a lot of people contest whether or not that's real. Certain ones like that. I mean, I think with gender dysphoria as well, I think a lot of people are attributing the distress that they feel, signs of gender nonconformity, a lot of times autistic traits, they're attributing these things to symptoms of gender dysphoria because there's a lot of overlap. And that's what I mean, that a lot of times symptoms or disorders are open to subjective interpretation. There's no objective test for them. So if somebody believes that they have a disorder, their perception kind of becomes the reality. And then they may end up getting some kind of interventions for it, like whether that's, you know, medical interventions to transition or antidepressants or things like that, that when they may not actually need them.
He's the most terrifying serial killer you've never heard of. Haddon Clark has confessed to several murders, but investigators say he could have over 100 victims. At the center of the mayhem, a cellmate of Haddon's that was able to get key evidence into Haddon's murder spree across America because Haddon thought he was Jesus Christ. Born Evil, The Serial Killer and the Savior, an ID true crime event, premieres Monday, September 2nd at 9. Watch on ID or stream on Max. Set your DVR.
Start your electric journey right here, right now. With a Volvo XC90 Recharge, our plug-in hybrid SUV with extended range. For more everyday electric journeys on a single charge, with a hybrid option for longer adventures, contact your local retailer to book a test drive or design your own vehicle at volvocars.com/US. The Volvo XC90 Recharge Plug-in Hybrid. The electric car with a backup plan.
Empower is here to help answer your financial questions and empower what's next. Because if you're like most people, you've probably had your fair share of stressors. Like, will you be able to afford a third kid? Will you be able to do everything you want during retirement? And what if you outlive your savings? Join 18 million Americans and take control of your financial future. Start today at empowered.com.
It feels like we had this moment in the early 2000s that was really good of, you know, we started speaking about mental health. And in some sense, I think it's a bit of a fallacy, this idea that we hadn't done so before. Nobody had done so before, because even if you read like Virginia Woolf, 100 years ago, she was writing very explicitly about mental health. And so people were, but I guess as a culture, we started to be more open talking about mental health in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. And it felt like we were at a sweet spot, and that it's gone so far now that you get virtue points. I mean, I remember being a kid and like, if I hurt my leg, I really wanted to get a cast, like a physical thing on my leg so that people could sign it. And like, I'd get loads of attention and things like that. Like we know that's a thing. We know about Munchausen by proxy. Humans like attention. Humans like to get virtue points and these kinds of things. Has that gone too far now? I guess that's why I asked before about the glamorization of mental illness.
Oh, definitely. I think, especially due to social media, it's taken on, you know, a social justice element. People have found, I mean, it's sort of a double-edged sword where, you know, you can find other people, you can have community, you can have support. But at the same time, these sort of, these groups, online communities form, whether it's for autism, like the neurodiversity movement, the chronic illness community, or in the trans community as well, they also become kind of echo chambers where they reinforce each other's views, and their illness or their disorder or whatever it is becomes very ingrained with who they are, their identity. I even think social media itself, like having a profile and desire to build a following around your niche interest, that also can kind of feed back into who you are.
Do you think there might be a problem with the parenting to lead to somebody? Because it seems like a sort of narcissism or a need for attention, and maybe they're not getting something at home. Certain people those who are too wrapped up in creating an identity around their particular mental illness or whatever it might be.
Right. I personally don't think that teens should be using social media in the way that they are now. I think, especially TikTok, they're learning about different types of disorders and psychiatric conditions from their peers, and they aren't really getting a good grasp of what it actually is. So they believe that they have a lot of these things, and they sort of make their whole identity around it and contribute to this community where self-diagnosis is valid and the world needs to accommodate them. I don't think it's contributing in a healthy way to themselves or to society.
How does autism play a role in some of the gender situation?
Heavily. I did a very thorough report on the connection between autism and gender dysphoria. It's approximately like 160 pages, but it's not out yet. And with it, I did a detransitioner survey and administered an autism spectrum quotient screening tool to that population for the first time. There's a lot of overlap that I found between autism and gender dysphoria. And what we also have going on is that young girls typically don't get diagnosed with autism until adulthood. Autism was typically considered a boy's diagnosis, and they thought, you know, there were 4 boys to every girl. It was what we're finding now is that girls typically just don't get diagnosed or recognized until adulthood, like as many as 80%.
Wow.
Aren't. And they suffer, they really suffer, especially during adolescence. What we're finding is that perhaps the diagnostic criteria and screening tools and things like that, they were sort of modeled after boys' traits. But we're finding that there's, you know, there's more of like, there is a female presentation of autism that looks differently. Girls are also more socially motivated and better at camouflaging their symptoms. And so they go undetected. And what I believe is happening, so you have this surge in trans identification among girls, many who are autistic, but maybe have not gotten diagnosed yet, or they don't recognize their autistic symptoms that overlap with their trans identity. So that's sort of my hypothesis that can account for like some of the surge in trans identification among teenage girls, that they're not diagnosed with autism yet, or they're attributing their autistic traits to signs of a trans identity. And that's what I found in my survey, that many of them, they didn't consider their trans identity a special interest at the time. But looking back now, they believe that that was their special interest. They interpreted signs. Gender nonconformity too is also very high in the autistic population. And I heard, it was just, I got so many comments from the survey that I did, that autism diagnosis in adulthood was what led to their decision to detransition. And that was it. That was what they were looking for. And I relate a lot to that, because when I finally got diagnosed at 30 by a psychiatrist, like, that, my whole life finally made sense.
That's interesting. What does it feel like for you to be autistic?
I never put it together. I always had the problems forming and maintaining friendships growing up. I went from one, obsessive interest to the next. I was always dealing with sensory issues. Like, in school, I wouldn't want to go to lunch where all the other kids were, because it was just so noisy and overwhelming. I would just go off and be by myself. And that was another contributor to having difficulty with friendships. And all of those things. And then, like, other things as well. Like, I have a lot of motor and balance issues. All of these other signs, like, everything just finally made sense. And I think
when I've watched Love on the Spectrum, I watched that, it was on an Australia version. It felt to me like a lot of them were interested in boys. Then the same people were like, oh, actually, maybe I want to go out with a girl. And I started to wonder if they maybe experienced sexuality differently, or I don't want to, apply it to all autistic people. But is there anything in that? Is sexuality and gender experienced differently by people on the spectrum?
There is a lot of research in that area as well, and they're finding a lot of variability in sexual orientation. There's a lot of homosexuality and bisexuality. Some people describe themselves as asexual. I think that both sexual orientation and autism are influenced by prenatal gonadal exposure. So there is some kind of link there.
That's interesting. So might it be that some people who are on the spectrum tend towards being asexual and not quite understanding how sexuality is for the rest of other people?
Yeah, definitely. There is that. I mean, I can't personally relate to that.
Autistic people,
Oh yeah. I mean, that was prevalent in the survey I did on detransitioners as well. There was only like 20% were heterosexual.
Interesting. So that's got to have some effect on ending up being trans or whatever it might be.
Yeah, definitely. High rates of gender nonconformity as well. But there's problems with the current conceptualization of autism too. Asperger's was removed in 2013. In the DSM, and was sort of consolidated into this broader umbrella diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder that's created a lot more problems, really. Just this totally unnecessary war between parents with children who have very high needs and adults on the spectrum with very low needs. And the neurodiversity movement has, I mean, there's a lot of parallels between what's going on with that and with gender activism as well, where neurodiversity advocates are trying to dictate what kind of research is done. So where there's a lot of activist influence in autism research as well, where they are trying to dictate what language can be used, and they don't even want people to search for causes of autism anymore because they think that it's going to be sort of used as like a eugenics or something like that. They think that, you know, if you search for a cure, we don't want to be cured. But this obviously conflicts with like parents who have children who are suffering from intellectual disabilities as well. And those rates are skyrocketing alongside just sort of the broader autism rates of diagnosis.
Interesting. What can parents do if their kids are lost, if they do believe they're the wrong gender? Is there anything they can do?
Yeah. I think what helped me a lot is learning about science and scientific thinking and critical thinking, stoicism, cognitive behavioral therapy. I think just talking to your kids and about everything that's going on with gender medicine around the world. So don't get them involved, get them engaged, get them learning about what's happening, listening to other perspectives. Just tell them everything that's going on and the concerns that people have about how there is really very little evidence to support the gender-affirming model of care.
Where can people find your work and follow what you're up to?
I'm Buttons Lives on X and Instagram. Buttonslives.news is my Substack, where I report on a lot of new studies and updates and things like that going on in the world of gender medicine.
And who is a heretic you admire?
I'm really grateful to Richard Dawkins for speaking up on this issue. I've always been a very big fan, but even more so now that he has a lot of influence in, you know, liberal science-minded circles. And I think he's probably going to lead to a lot more people feeling brave enough to speak up.
He's a great heretic.
Thank you so much to Christina Buttons. Thank you all for listening. I hope you found that really interesting. A bit different, what's going on with all the lies from Paris Hilton and all of these things. So please do give her a follow on Instagram and Twitter. Get hold of her Substack as well. And I will see you next time.